I'm Dan Masterson, host of Strategy Talk, where we take a unique view of world events. We report news as history. With me today is the editor of StrategyPage.com and well-known military author, Jim Dunnigan. Associate editor and syndicated columnist, Austin Bay, also joins us.
Welcome, Austin and Jim. Thought we'd talk a little bit about what's going on in Yemen currently. There's been activity over the last 2 weeks. Jim, could you just give us a brief synopsis of what's happened and how things are changing there in Yemen?
All right. For over 1,000 years, the Shia in northern Yemen and southern Saudi Arabia, actually, they're still there, were independent. In the last 50 years, the Saudi Arabian Kingdom happened in the 1930s. And that took care of the Shia, down there, who are related ethnically and religiously to the ones across the border in Yemen. But until the 1960s, the ones in Yemen still had a lot of autonomy. They were, in effect, a separate kingdom that took orders, foreign affairs was handled by, the government in Yemen. Yemen, however, was always divided. They were two separate countries after the 60s, North Yemen and South Yemen. They united in the 1990s. It took two civil wars, that's how complicated things are in Yemen, to make that happen, but it didn't last. A Shia named Saleh basically was president for life for over 20 years, and he was turfed out as a result of the Arab Spring in 2011. The new guy, elected in 12, I believe it was, he was on paper, a breath of fresh air. However, what people didn't realize was that Saleh had served one very important function. He kept the Shia under control, being a Shia himself, although not highly respected in the Shia territory because he was basically spending all his time with Sunnis. He could make deals, and he kept things quiet. With Saleh gone, things were no longer quiet. The Shia up there have been rebellious and troublesome ever since they had their autonomy taken away in the 1960s. They never got over that. But in the last few years, about the last, say, 5 or 10 years, they got organized big time. First it was one tribe, then it was another tribe. They're called the Houthis after the chief troublemaker. But basically it's a coalition that has grown only stronger as they went from success to success. Now, the immediate cause of the fighting up there were the Sunni tribes. The Sunni are by far the majority, 70-80% of the population. And there are always have been tribes up there, but they were basically keeping their heads down because they were outnumbered by the heavily armed and very touchy Shia tribes up there. These guys had a reputation up there for being very short-tempered and quick to take offense. But the younger Sunnis and some of the Sunni clerics up there got the idea that this wave of Sunni radicalism, fundamentalism, and terrorism sweeping the world, starting actually in the 1970s, and it only got bigger. It only got noticed in the West in the 90s, actually. And it infected them, and they began to believe their own press releases, and they started basically recruiting Islamic terrorists. They sustained, they built, basically maintained, and publicized our religious schools, which taught you old school hate non-Shia, hate non-Sunni Muslims, big time. And the Shia began to feel this. And the Shia decided, damn it, we're not going to have these wackos in our own backyard. So they basically declared war on the madrasas, the religious schools, that were turning out the largest number of basically the Islamic terrorists, for want of a better term. I mean, these guys were out looking for blood. And this developed into a larger and larger war. The Shia eventually won that, but in the meantime, the government, the Saleh government, had collapsed. And the new regime, new elected president, found himself presiding over a mess. In other words, all these separate parties, tribes, religious, political, you name it, in Yemen were now lost. And were no longer, or in other words, the place was always corrupt. There was always payoffs and secret deals to, you know, keep everybody in line. These were all went away with Saleh. And further complicating the issue was Saleh himself negotiated a deal to peacefully depart, which gave him immunity. Now, he was also supposed to leave the country, but he didn't. That should have warned everybody that this is only going to get worse. He's believed to be behind a lot of this business, because one reason the Shia were so successful was a lot of military units didn't fight the Shia. They just sort of stood aside. Now, why would they do that? Because the new president eliminated the more obvious officers, especially generals, who were basically Saleh's boys. What he missed were the not-so-obvious guys who still felt affinity for the old dictator. So the Shia start marching south, and the government finds out they got no way to stop them. Now, it gets worse because despite the numeric superiority and the fact that all these Sunni tribes have lots of weapons, I mean, Yemen is the most heavily armed per capita country in the world. I think they even outdo the United States, possibly not a few states out west, maybe not Utah, but maybe Wyoming. But everybody has weapons and they're quick to use them. But the tribes are too busy fighting each other over control of the oil. A lot of them were supporting Al-Qaeda in Yemen, which is an organization that was formed when the authorities finally chased Al-Qaeda out in the after 2003, after 2005, actually. And they gave them sanctuary, and this is why we're getting all these terrorism scares, you know, out of Yemen, because basically they had a place where they could operate without fear of being, you know, bombed. The Sunni basically were not united, and the Shia were. It's as simple as that. And so what we've got month by month, again, it doesn't pop up in the headlines because there's something dramatic happening, but, you know, earlier this year, the Shia moved into the, quietly, in effect, I mean, first they sent unarmed protesters into the capital, followed with, accompanied by a few gunmen for protection, only, of course. But, of course, a lot of those peaceful protesters were unarmed but not familiar with the use of arms. And before you know it, they had an army in the capital, and it was a fait accompli. There was nothing the government could do. Now, all this time, the Shia were talking the talk. In other words, they were asking for reform. They wanted a new government that was honest. Now, a lot of Shia actually believe this. They're not, as the Sunni like to say, just a, you know, a Trojan horse for the Iran, for the, you know, the global Shia revolution. A lot of them really just want, and a lot of other Yemenis want honest government, which is alien, you know, to the Yemeni way of doing things. And basically the newly elected government isn't giving into these reforms because this would destroy the traditional fabric of Yemeni culture and politics. Their own righteousness has turned out to be one of the more powerful weapons. And a lot of Sunni go along with this. Now, again, this is Yemen, this is Arabia. Who's telling the truth? Who's scamming who? Who knows? Seriously, I mean, there's nobody has any concrete proof of any chicanery, although it looks very suspicious. Because Iran has been caught, literally, shipping weapons clandestinely, you know, to the Shia in Yemen, and there have been a few agents, they might have really been merchants, who the hell knows, you know, bringing in money and what have you, but there's not been a lot of overt support, overt physical or financial support from Iran, although, and this drives the Arabs nuts, in Iran itself. Well, a lot of Arabs visit on business, whatever. There's an Arab minority in Iran, you know, so that it's, you can get in and out of the country. And if you speak Farsi, the Iranian language, you can basically pick up what the talk on the street. And the street is, we just won a great victory in Yemen. Now, you can imagine how well this goes over in Arabia, because the official Iranian government position is, oh, no, we have nothing to do with this. So who are you going to believe? The government? What everybody's saying on the street. Well, in this part of the world, it's hard to say because, you know, the government may indeed be honest about, hey, you know, we're not doing nothing. Whereas on the street, they look at this and say, hey, whether our government did anything, which is unlikely in some parts of the world, our guys are winning. You know, it's like a sports competition. So this is the situation we have now. The Shia, whether they intended to, whether they have Iranian backing, for whatever reason, they are slowly taking over the country. Now, the reality, the thing that the news media tend not to dwell on, is the fact that the odds against them actually taking control of the entire country are slight, because they are still a small minority. They don't literally have the numbers of guys with guns, no matter how dedicated they are, to take on a mobilized Sunni tribal opposition. And in the last week or so, the Sunni tribes down there have been basically calling for an assembly of the anti-Shia tribe. They're basically saying, guys, forget about your beefs with each other. We got to stomp on the Shia scum, which is one of the kinder words they Sunnis apply to Shia, and mobilize in the Marib province, which coincidentally is where the oil is. And we'll gather, they're looking for 30,000, warriors, and we'll work, and we'll get the chiefs together, we'll work out a plan, and then we'll go do the deed. Now, they haven't done the deed yet, but this is making the Shia rather nervous. Now, to further complicate matters, things are never simple in this part of the world. The king of Saudi Arabia just died. Now, his policy had always been, don't get involved in Yemen. You know, it's like the Turks and the Arabs in general. Don't get involved in the affairs of the Arabs. Well, the Saudis had their own. God's sake, you know, do not get too involved in Yemen, because nothing good ever comes out of it. The new guy is not a radical. I mean, he's in his 70s, the crown prince who is now the king. But he has replaced a lot of the ministers. And one of the interesting, you know, changes was the new defense minister is not all that experienced, and apparently the king is going to take a more active interest in military affairs. Now, the only military affair they can think of now is, well, the obvious one, ISIL in Syria and Iraq, but that's really taken care of, by and large, as much as they can. The other one, which has been screaming for attention, is what's going on in Yemen. Now, the Saudis could, on paper, move a fairly substantial force across the border. Remember, the Shia in Yemen are in the north. And right across the border, they have cousins who've been living fairly contentedly under Saudi rule for, you know, generations. And they are expected to stand aside. They want even less to do with what their cousins are doing out in Yemen. But the Saudis can move across and do great damage simply by occupying the tribal areas where the families are, you know, basically going into the enemy's rear area. And this has got the Shia gunmen a little concerned, because basically they are in central Yemen, and they've been making, how should I put it, raids, large-scale raids further south. They haven't regime in the major port in southern Yemen yet. But this was the great fear everybody has. So they have an unstable situation up in Saudi Arabia, or unpredictable. Plus they have, to the east, they have these 10,000, up to 30,000, probably something closer to 10,000, but 10,000 Sunni tribesmen mobilizing, coming in from all over the southern and eastern Yemen. And, of course, a large number of angry Sunni tribesmen around them. And they can do the math, they're outnumbered. And everybody's waiting to see what they're going to do. Will they go for broke? Say, hey, we've been lucky so far, let's keep going. You know, the gambler's fallacy, we call it in the West. Or are they going to basically start negotiating and pull back? They still hold the capital, because that is in the north. Basically north of the capital is all Shia territory. South of the capital, it's more and more Sunni. And basically do what they've always said they wanted to do, simply negotiate more autonomy, better terms for themselves. That's where we are right now, in a situation that is murky, unpredictable, and no one really knows what the hell's going on. Welcome to Arabia.
Austin, how's this affecting the United States' war on terror there, because it is Yemen has been touted as part of the success that we've had over the last few months.
Oh, it's been touted, hasn't it? Touted. I want to make a cut before we explore my sarcasm. I want to make a couple of comments on what Jim said. One very minor point. You know, he talked about something called what Shia scum. You said, did it ring a bell with an Arab friend of mine who occasionally provides translations of some things that go on websites that politically correct would go up in arms if they know what is actually written on some of these Arabic websites. I'm talking about Muslim websites, about other Muslim sects. S-E-C-T-S, Dan, not S-E-X. Sects, or much less on strategy page, Jim, and every once in a blue moon, mentions what goes on Palestinian and Arab websites vis-a-vis Israel. I mean, the thing is, some of the same verbiage is turned into these intramural Islamic and I'm Islamist, intramural Islamist. They're wars, man. They are. I mean, and that's the part of what you're seeing in Yemen. So when someone talks to you about the Islam problem or Muslim problem, they really haven't looked at the fragmentation. And which leads to a comment. I'm going to get to your try to answer your question about how it affects the U.S. War on Terror. But we don't have a map in front of us. But Jim did an outstanding job of describing the Yemeni Shia regions. Think central. Northern Yemen. Remember, there's one big Yemen now, but there was a northern Yemen and a southern Yemen. Southern Yemen basically collected around the port of Aden and then spreads east along the bottom of the Arabian Peninsula until it hits Oman. And Aden is a very demographically mixed place. A big port. It's Arab, but it's a little bit of everything else. Indian, East African, it's what you get out of what was the superport and the biggest British base at one time in that region. And if we had a map in front of us, Dan, you'd see that the Sunni and I'll even call them anti-royalists, because there was a large socialist and communist movement in Aden in the 1950s and 1960s. In fact, as they had they had a fairly powerful left-wing party at one time. Well, they are they stand firmly against the quote-unquote northern tribes. Now, if we had a map in front of us to take the what is essentially northern Yemen with a few spots and pizza pie blotches, that's the Shia tribes, and then the south is a big mix. Remember too that Bin Laden's family had Yemeni connections. I think it's from the eastern part of southern Yemen. But let's get to Jim's point too about what the Saudis could do to the Yemeni tribes. And remember that these guys have got their own brand of Shiism. It's an interesting split. I'm trying to remember the name of it. Zaidi, I think, but it shares some of the characteristics of Iraqi Shiism, but they also subscribe to some of the beliefs of the neighboring Sunnis in Saudi. The Shia Arab communities, and they're Yemeni, that are inside what is politically Saudi Arabia, as Jim points out, they have, you know, cousins right across the border in Yemen. Well, for a long time, these those tribes have done a lot of business with both the government in Riyadh and traders on the Persian Gulf, because they have reputation as outstanding metal workers. They do a lot of work in gold. You go into some of the and I'm mentioning this at the microeconomic level because it's a big deal for those Shia tribes within Saudi Arabia. A lot of the jewelry stores in Khobar and in the Al Hasa area of Saudi Arabia, you talk to the proprietors there and they say, oh, comes down from the Saudi Yemeni border. They can even tell you the tribes and some of the people that they work with, because they've been dealing with them for a long time. That's where those tribes make their coin. And this also gives them more than just a geographic relationship with the Saudis, despite the political division. What Jim outlined as a response by Saudi Arabia actually is something that would benefit the ongoing U.S. war on terror against al-Qaeda in the Arabian Peninsula, which operates primarily from bases in Yemen. Now, has this revolution damaged U.S. efforts? I'd say yes. As Jim says, what do we know for sure? Well, there's a lot of chaos. Reporting is inconsistent. Sometimes people who think they know something and are trying to tell the truth don't know what they're talking about, and you get an honest rendition of something that didn't occur. Oftentimes you get a lot of the, and what I'm saying, that international journalists have to really be careful when they get sources from some of these people. They know that they can be spun, because it's very hard, Dan, and very dangerous to get into many of these areas and verify what is going on. That said, I think it's pretty clear that we've had to withdraw or vacate areas places that we utilized in our operations against al-Qaeda in the Arabian Peninsula. If the Saudis, as Jim said, occupy a few homes in eastern Yemen, that's a Saudi move, but it's, ultimately it's a trade. It's an opportunity for some horse trading there to get bases, observation points, allow to move special operations units to on reconnaissance missions and the like. It's in a theoretical level, this is the weakness of the argument about counter-terror versus counter-insurgency. You know, there's a spectrum in there, but when you're in a counter-insurgent operation, you have larger areas that you yourself are trying to control, that you have some stability in, and you use those as the basis for your counter-terror operations. When you don't have an ongoing counter-insurgency operation, you have to, and you're fighting a counter-terror war, you have to respond and utilize local allies, and in the example here of what's happened in Yemen, sometimes the local allies topple and they disappear. That's just part of the process. It's a reason to be careful when you tout a success politically. I think here's the damage to the U.S. administration is once again, how closely this is followed by the American public could be easily debated, so that don't follow it at all. But the administration made great claims about it last fall, you know, during the election, and now you have actions on the ground that are setbacks that call into question those claims. My own view is that, hey, we've had credible successes in Yemen, Anwar al-Awlaki's removal by drone. We have damaged al-Qaeda in the Arabian Peninsula. But we've also got the Islamic State popping up in another power vacuum, you know, eastern Syria, northwestern Iraq. It's a long struggle, and the Charlie Hebdo massacre, I think, underlines, I know damn well, emphasizes the nature of a long struggle.
Jim, how is this going to affect relationships with Saudi Arabia, with the king dying, and what's going on in Yemen, and whatever other machinations are happening in the area?
Well, Saudi Arabia is the de facto head of the Gulf Cooperation Council, which is the organization created actually by one of the smaller states, of all the, you know, the smaller states, Oman, which is not so small, and not Yemen. The oil states, in effect. And Saudi Arabia has been very prudent, careful. We might call them, you know, overly reluctant. But, you know, that's what works for them. You know, so, you know, even American people will not say, look, you got to respect, that's how they do business in this part of the world. Of course, they also support, by being prudent and easygoing, they end up supporting a lot of Islamic, you know, terrorist groups by looking the other way as wealthy Saudis and other wealthy people from around the Gulf, the Arab states, send millions of dollars a year to Islamic terrorist groups. But that aside, every time there's, you know, a new king, there could be changes. And that has people concerned because, you know, that's the way it goes. It's always the way it is. Even in democracies, you know, a new president's elected, you know, things are going to change. And we saw that, you know, with Obama coming in, you know, after a bunch of, you know, Republican, you know, presidents. However, the Saudi Arabia is a much more volatile country. It contains the Islamic most holy places, Mecca and Medina and so forth. And it's basically the head of a growing war with Iranian Shia. The Shia is a small sect. It's only about 10% of all Muslims. But, you know, the Iranians are the leader, and the Iranians have a track record of beating on Arabs successfully, going back thousands of years, literally. They've lost a few times. That's one reason why they're Muslim, and not their ancient Zoroastrian religion. But that aside, well, some Arabs think the biggest mistake we ever made was converting them to Islam, but that's a whole other story. But the Saudi Arabia has been quite effective as the leader of the, you know, the Arabian Arab states. And they recognize that. You know, they haven't been dramatic, they haven't been as bold, they haven't been as militant as the Iranians have. But that's the Iranian, you know, way of operating. The Iranians are also very prudent. You know, they talk a big game, but they've always done that. But you got to remember, 2,000 years ago, they were the ones who were defeating the Romans. Very few people defeated the Romans. And the Persians back then, or, you know, the Iranian tribes, or kingdoms, actually, they were doing it. So, and the Iranians are well aware of their past. And one reason they want nuclear weapons is so they can basically become a major, you know, power again. And the Saudis are concerned about this because a major power means the Arab states become basically subsidiaries of Iran, Inc. And they do not want that. So all the Arabs are looking to the Saudi Arabia, as is the West, because most of the oil still comes out of the Persian Gulf, and most of it is Arab oil. And we have to be concerned because if you get someone in the on the throne in Saudi Arabia that makes a big mistake, the world feels it. So the basic problem here is nobody knows what's going to happen next. Now, discussions are going on furiously and frequently over the last week and will continue. And it's hard to say if any decisions have been made on what to do. It is interesting to note that just the other day, there was another American zone, a missile strike in from a UAV in Yemen. Those operations are continuing. Now, one of the bases that the Americans used was captured by the Shia yesterday. So, of course, we weren't using that base anymore. It was a training base. But we're basically losing a lot of the bases that we previously relied upon. We can fly these UAV missions out of the Persian Gulf or Djibouti, just across the Gulf of Aden. So we're not going to lose all of our bases there. But it's a period of change, and that always scares people, justifiably, because you don't know where you're going to land.
Yeah.
Hey, Dan, let me make a. I know we're coming up on time. Let me make a couple of quick. Quick points. What Jim just said about losing bases, that's what I was alluding to when you're finding counter-terror, quote-unquote, more, or counter-insurgency. The base we lost yesterday was, I think, I read that last night that we hadn't used it since 2012, but it's still an asset, and it's viewed on the ground there as, quote-unquote, an American base, so it's touted as a, quote-unquote, victory for the rebels. I'm not saying that it is much of a victory, but that's the way they tout it. I think, Jim, you meant to say Iranians sometimes wonder why they adopted Islam. I thought you may have said Arabs adopting.
No, I meant Arab.
Oh, you did? Okay. All right, because the Iranians do as well.
It's a moment of weakness, but the joke now is we should have left them as pagans.
Yeah. All right.
They were threatening to take control of the Islamic world.
All right, but my point is thanks for clarifying that. On the back to Iran, I meant to say this first time and I forgot. Iran basically has control of the Strait of Hormuz. It was the outlet to the Persian Gulf. We write about that all the time. But they have been playing games around the Bab al Mandab for what ever since the Ayatollah's revolution in 1979. They've had a finger in Eritrea, and here's Yemen, and the Bab al Mandab is the strait connecting the Red Sea to the Gulf of Aden, which is the Indian Ocean. There's a strategic component there that plays into Iranian. Well, the Iranians are interested in it. It's another choke point that they can use to play with oil prices and also it doesn't just affect Europeans, Americans, Japanese, and the like. It affects the Saudis because their ability to export and quantity their oil. So there's a very dangerous chess match that's going on, and anybody looks at the big map can see and understands tanker routes, sees that this is at play in Tehran, Dan. It's definitely at play.
Right. Well, I guess we'll watch this always volatile, but even more volatile area of the world, and we'll talk to you gentlemen next time.
All right, bye, Dan. Bye.
Bye.
Bye, guys.